and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Trump's attempted theft of the election now in plain sight as he tries to prevent the certification of election results in Michigan in the hope the Republican legislatures in Michigan, Wisconsin, Arizona, and Georgia will follow suit and deny Biden enough Electoral College votes to overturn the will of the people. To that end, Trump has invited a dozen Republican members of the Michigan State Legislature to the White House on Friday for a meeting after having reached out to two Michigan Republican canvassers, Monica Palmer and William Hartman, who initially voted against certifying the results this Tuesday, deadlocking the Wayne County Board of Canvassers 2-2. After they backed down, Trump called them, supposedly to thank them for their support. Then, surprise, surprise, the pair have now signed affidavits saying they want to rescind their certification of Wayne County's results. Brian Colt, the Harold Norris Faculty Scholar and Professor of Law at Michigan State University and author of Constitutional Cliffhangers, A Legal Guide for Presidents and Their Enemies, joins us to discuss how American democracy now rests on how corrupt and cynical Republican lawmakers are. Then we will speak with Juan Cole, Professor of Modern Middle Eastern and South Asian History and author of Muhammad, Prophet of Peace Amid the Clash of Empires, and author of the blog Inform Comment, where his latest article is Trump's Requested Strike on Iran Could Kill More People Than Atomic Bombing of Nagasaki. We will assess how much the man-child in the Oval Office who is sulking and stewing over the election he lost is prepared to salt the earth and tie Biden's hands with reckless and destructive moves that could have devastating consequences. Then finally, we'll speak with Jennifer Kavanaugh, Director of the Strategy, Doctrine, and Resources Program at the Rand Arroyo Center, who leads Rand's Countering Truth Decay initiative, who has an op-ed at the Los Angeles Times, How Biden Can Stop Truth Decay and Restore the Public's Faith in Politics. And before we go to our first guest, I want to thank you, our listeners and supporters, who have donated to sustain and build Background Briefing as the radio station we broadcast from closes down and we transition to online broadcasting, particularly during this pandemic. Your donations will help us improve our recording capabilities from home, so we encourage you to throw us a lifeline and join the fact-based community of listeners we are building around the globe with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. Which helps keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to all those who are not in a position to contribute. And joining us now is Brian Colt, who's the Harold Norris Faculty Scholar and Professor of Law at Michigan State University. He's the author of Constitutional Cliffhangers, A Legal Guide for Presidents and Their Enemies. Welcome to Background Briefing, Brian Colt.
Thanks for having me.
So Michigan is now in the crosshairs of Donald Trump's flaying about trying to win an election that he lost. But it looks like he's getting some cooperation. Now, there was an incident in Wayne County where the election board there voted 2-2, Democrats and Republicans, in a deadlock. And then there was quite a bit of a backlash. And then finally, the four-county board of canvassers briefly, after blocking the vote on Tuesday, then they backed down a few hours later. But then subsequent to that, President Trump called at least one of the Republicans on the Wayne County canvassing board. And after that conversation where she said he was just basically hoping that she kept safe because she was apparently being threatened, etc. But now, subsequent to that call, lo and behold, these pair of Republicans have now signed affidavits saying they want to rescind the certification of the Wayne County results. So I'm trying to keep up with this, Brian, but you're there. So what's the latest?
Well, it's not clear to me what the effect of their attempt to rescind their votes is, to the extent that they had already approved it and the numbers had been sent to the state. But if their rescission is effective, then what that would mean is not that the votes are not certified, but rather that the state board of canvassers would come in, take some more time, have some more resources, and they would do the canvassing. They would certify the numbers in the end. Although, who knows what they'll do? Right, they're balanced by party as well. But the sense is that they would sign off on the numbers, or if nothing else, at least certify a winner. The numbers at issue here are tiny, especially in comparison to the large margin by which Biden won the state.
156,000 votes.
Last I checked, it was 150, almost 158.
Okay. Well, certainly a lot more than what Trump won narrowly by in 2016. But would you agree that it's a bit of a coincidence that after the president had the phone conversation with Monica Palmer, they decided to rescind their certification?
I think it looks highly questionable. I don't think that it's appropriate for a candidate to be talking to the canvassers. And there's no good reason for him to do that, only bad ones.
Well, apparently there is going to be a delegation from the Michigan legislature, Republicans. They're going to fly to Washington tomorrow on President Trump's invitation to meet him in the White House. So what's that all about?
Well, that's pretty disturbing, too. So the plan, being behind by more than 150,000 votes, President Trump's plan appears to be to prevent the certification of that total. He can't get enough numbers to win, to be certified as the winner, which leaves him with the option of having nobody certified as the winner. If he could do that, which he probably can't, but assuming he does, then the legislature under federal law, Title III of the U.S. Code, Section 2, says if the state doesn't choose a winner in their election, then the legislature can just name a winner. And there are Republican majorities in both the State House and the State Senate. So presumably, he's trying to get them to commit to declaring him the winner if there is no certification, or maybe even if there is a certification, although that would probably not work. It's worth noting that the Senate Majority Leader, at least, had already, the Republican Senate Leader, had already declared that Biden won the state and the legislature isn't going to do anything about it. But who knows what sort of inducements the president might be attempting to offer.
And again, I'm speaking with Brian Colt, who's the Harold Norris Faculty Scholar and Professor of Law at Michigan State University, and the author of Constitutional Cliffhangers, A Legal Guide for Presidents and Their Enemies. And so if this is going to be a constitutional cliffhanger, is it enough in terms of the Electoral College for Michigan to, in effect, go against the will of the voters and have their electors, their Republican electors, vote for Trump in the Electoral College?
No, Michigan only has 16 electoral votes. So even without those, Biden would still have 290. Although presumably if the president is thinking of doing this, then he's also looking at what he might be able to pull in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Georgia and Arizona.
All of whom have Republican legislatures, right?
Yes. There are Democratic governors in Michigan and Wisconsin, but it's not clear how much power the governor has over a state that doesn't certify a result. If the state does certify a result, the governor signs off on that. That is presumptively valid in the count when Congress counts the votes in January. But if there is no certification, the legislature can choose who gets the votes, and it looks like the governor would not have a veto over that.
So what does this come down to then? Does this come down to individual Republican lawmakers and their conscience? I mean, if you look at what's happening in Georgia, for example, it's quite interesting that the Secretary of State turns out to be a mensch, turns out to be a decent guy, and he's not bowing to pressure from Republicans, both in the state from his own two senators who are running in this important runoff, but also from Senator Lindsey Graham, who apparently tried to get him to toss out a bunch of mail-in votes, which is in itself seems highly irregular, if not illegal. But he's standing his ground. Is that what it comes down to? If you mentioned the head of the Michigan Senate, the Republican head of the Michigan Senate, that he's already declared the state for Biden, and he may well be pressured. So does it come down to the individual conscience of these lawmakers?
It might not, which is to say, if they do the right thing, if they do their job the way they did 4 years ago, when there were even more discrepancies in Detroit, also not enough to make a difference in the result, but everyone did their job and certified the winner properly. If they do their job, then it's over. If they don't, it's not clear that that would even be enough. Even if there are disputes over the electoral votes in enough states to deny Biden a majority, if they all go his way, it's still up to Congress to count the votes in January. And with the Democrats controlling the House, it's not clear that this would work, even if the Republicans go along with Trump. Now, hopefully it won't come to that. It would do great damage to the system to have it come to that. But they could certainly end this quickly by not going, the Republican officials in these states could end this quickly by not going along with these shenanigans.
And of course, the Congress certifies on January the 6th of 2021, which is the day after the runoff elections in Georgia. And if the Democrats were to win both of those runoff seats in the Senate, they'd still be one vote short, would they not? Because the vice president who would preside over the tie vote would be Mike Pence.
Yes, and even if the Democrats were to win on the 5th, they would not be able to get those totals certified and the senators seated in enough time to do that anyway. But yes, Pence does have the tie-breaking vote at this point until the 20th.
So what can Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer and the Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson and Attorney General Dana Nessel, who are all Democrats, they're not going to basically twiddle their thumbs while this naked attempt to steal Michigan's vote by Trump and by his Republican enablers in the state. What can they do?
The most important thing in the short term is to make sure that the results are certified. And if the State Board of Canvassers isn't going to do that, there's the possibility of legal action, a writ of mandamus from a state court to require them to do it, to say there's not any doubt here as to who the winner is. So they could litigate. Once the courts decide, then everything else would fall into place. The governor would sign off on the certification. Congress would count those votes. And again, it bears repeating, there's nothing that has been alleged in court to suggest any threat to this 150,000 vote lead. President Trump tweeted, "In Detroit, there are far more votes than people," in all caps, which is just patently false. Turnout was lower in Detroit than it was in the rest of the state. But the numbers that he's actually disputing in court are tiny, and there's just no way that they could legitimately certify him as the winner, and there's really no way for them to legitimately not certify Biden as the winner. So I think the Democratic Secretary of State, the Democratic governor, holds all the cards here.
So what do you make of the criticism of these two members of the Board of Canvassers in Wayne County, Palmer and Hartman, who obviously voted in a way that didn't make any sense, but then under pressure, they reversed their vote. And now, after a conversation that Monica Palmer had with President Trump, they've decided to try and contest the certification again. Much of the criticism, of course, leveled at them was that this was purely racist because Wayne County is predominantly African American, and no such efforts were done in other nearby counties that were predominantly white. So would naming and shaming any of these Republican officials and lawmakers be sufficient? Does that work, or did it work in this case with these two?
Well, it initially looked like it did before they rescinded it. But I want to point out, Wayne County is actually majority white. And Detroit, the largest city in Wayne County, is overwhelmingly majority black. And so part of the problem with what they did is the discrepancy between how they treated Detroit, the one-third of the county, but predominantly black, versus the rest of the county. So they pointed to the issues with reconciling the total number of votes in some precincts in Detroit and said, oh, well, there's some of these don't balance. And we're talking about tiny numbers, like you're balancing your checkbook and you have thousands of dollars in the account and you're looking for a 1 or 2 cent discrepancy. They had some discrepancies. There were not nearly as many discrepancies as there were 4 years ago when they had no trouble certifying the result. And there were also discrepancies in the other parts of the county that were white. So the city of Livonia, which is almost entirely white, had discrepancies. They didn't seem to have any problem with those. They were happy enough to sign off on the results in Livonia, just not in Detroit. And there are two possible explanations, not exclusive of each other, for this. One is just noting that Detroit voted by a 200,000 vote margin in favor of Biden, which is decisive in the result in the state. So if they can hold that up, Trump can win. And the other is that that 200,000 vote margin came from a heavily majority black part of a majority white county. And so if they have it in their mind that it's not legitimate because they voted for Biden and because they're black, it would certainly explain everything that they did. It certainly looks like they deserve the criticism that they got, as far as I'm concerned.
But Palmer and Hartman, they backed down and they agreed to certify the Wayne County results because the Michigan Secretary of State promised to conduct an audit. So that's what they said before then they, of course, reversed themselves later after the conversation with Trump, at least on Palmer's part. So, I mean, how could you deny 200,000 votes, just make them disappear? The audits usually don't turn up much of a discrepancy, only if, you know, like the what last in 2016 when they redid the count in Michigan, I think it only changed by about 130 votes. So that's not likely to make any difference. So I'm trying to understand how you could possibly disappear 200,000 votes from African Americans in Detroit and then turn around and win Michigan without this being a kind of, you know, naked robbery in plain sight. I don't understand how you could get away with that.
Well, I guess we'll see. I don't think that they're trying to get the result certified that Trump was the winner. I don't think that's possible because the issues, the irregularities people are talking about are not sufficient to throw out a lot of votes, certainly not 150,000. What their goal would be is to say the process is so messed up that we can't certify anyone as the winner at all. That's not, in this case, backed up by the facts. There's no legal argument for that. They're not going to win in court. Trump, I think, realizes that he's not going to win in court. And as a result, is looking for the weak link in the chain in the process. And we always sort of take it for granted that these things are done in good faith, and they generally had been until now. But what we see is that the system relies on people proceeding in good faith. The system relies on norms. And if people violate those norms, they can cause a fair amount of mischief. And I trust the institutions to sort this out correctly in the end, but it shouldn't require a heroic intervention by courts and by other administrators. So I agree with you. I don't see how anyone could, in good faith and good conscience, be doing what they're doing.
But just in closing, if there is a strategy here, And there appears to be one, the strategy on the part of the White House, and we don't know exactly what's going to go on tomorrow when members of the Michigan Republican State House visit the White House, what they'll be discussing. But if they can get up to enough shenanigans to hold up the certification of the vote in Michigan, then they could throw it to the legislatures and hold up the count in the Electoral College, but they would only win, what, 11? How many seats, how many electors will they get? It won't make any difference in the overall count for the president as far as Biden's concerned, because he's got such a long lead. So at the end of the day, Trump would have to do the same mischief in Michigan, Georgia, Arizona, and Pennsylvania, right?
Three of those four. So he needs 26 votes total, and any three of those four would be enough. So yes, he would have to prevent the certification, and he would have to get the legislature to vote his way, and he would need Congress to accept that, and he would need to do it in three of those four states.
Well, I guess this is a question at the end of the day, Brian, whether the better angels in this country will prevail over this kind of really unbelievable, brazen, I was going to say theft, but I'll say misconduct.
Attempted theft.
Attempted theft. I thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Brian Colt, who's the Harold Norris Faculty Scholar and Professor of Law at Michigan State University and the author of Constitutional Cliffhangers, A Legal Guide for Presidents and Their Enemies. We're going to take a brief station break and back, assessing how much the man-child in the Oval Office, who is sulking and stewing over the election he lost, is prepared to salt the earth and tie Biden's hands with reckless and destructive moves that could have devastating consequences. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan. He's also the author of the blog Inform Comment at juancole.com and the author of The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Engaging the Muslim World. And his latest book is Muhammad, Prophet of Peace Amid the Clash of Empires. And his latest article at Inform Comment is Trump's Requested Strike on Iran Could Kill More People Then atomic bombing of Nagasaki. Welcome to Background Briefing, Juan Cole.
Thank you, Ian.
Well, thank you for joining us, Juan. And a week ago, Thursday, in the White House, apparently President Trump told his top aides that he wanted to bomb Iran. And he was talked out of it, supposedly, by Vice President Pence, Secretary of State Pompeo, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Mark Milley. But we don't really know with this president where things are, where they really stand. The fact that he asked for plans to bomb Iran is extraordinary and scary. And apparently his top aides suggested that it could basically turn the entire region into a firestorm. But surely that is what this is all about, isn't it? Trump just wants to salt the earth for Joe Biden. He wants to leave such a mess. He wants to tie his hands. He wants to make life miserable. He's a vindictive, horrible person who is just full of hate and venom and can't deal with the fact that he lost an election and doesn't give a damn about the American people, let alone the people of the Middle East.
Well, I can't disagree with any of that, Ian. The only addendum I might make is that it's not impossible that he has aspirations to make a comeback in 2024. And that might be at least a little bit of a break on his destructiveness, in the sense that if he were known as the man who started a big shooting war with Iran in the last days of his administration, which then went very bad, that might damage his reputation among his base, who are the only people that he cares about, many of whom don't like the Middle East forever wars. So I think he'd be taking a risk to his political future, whatever that might be, were he to go forward. And my suspicion is that if he was dissuaded from this course of action, it was because his age told him that it would hurt him down the road.
Well, we've already seen what Iran can do asymmetrically. And I think the most instructive example is their attack on the Saudi oil facility at Abqaiq, which is key to the Saudi export of oil to the world. And they fired a bunch of cruise missiles from Farsi Island and shut the place down. Now, we also know that they did a very, very calibrated and careful retaliation to the killing of the Soleimani, who was a hugely popular, important figure, the head of the IRGC. The Ayatollah Khamenei wept over his casket at the funeral. So they have exhibited a very clever asymmetrical response in the past, but they've also exhibited restraint. But if you attack them in the way that Trump apparently was talking about doing or wanted to do, all bets are off, aren't they?
Yes, although, as I mentioned in my piece, I think the thing that we might concentrate on more than the likelihood of an Iranian response, which, as you say, is quite grave, is that bombing a nuclear facility is not like, you know, Trump dropped that so-called mother of all bombs on Afghanistan. And he struck Syria at Khan Yunus. But it's not like that. When you drop a conventional bomb on a nuclear enrichment facility, it is more or less like using a dirty bomb. A dirty bomb being a bomb that is laced with radioactive material. So you'd be releasing hexafluoride uranium gas, which is deadly, is toxic, which is used in the enrichment process. You'd be throwing up radioactive fallout, just as with an atomic bomb, which would have long-term impacts on health. In Hiroshima, we saw a big spike in leukemia among children in the aftermath of the atomic bombing. And the death toll, depending upon what exactly is attacked, if all four facilities are attacked, the death toll from just the release of gas could be anywhere up to the 70,000 people. And then you have the radioactivity and so forth. So this would be a world historical bombing. It wouldn't be an ordinary Trump-style one-off bombing of an enemy.
Well, as you point out in your article, of course, uranium hexafluoride gas, in many ways, it's more deadly than the fallout that comes from a nuclear weapon where the fissile material has been burned up. But there's also the danger of the Markazi aquifer, which supplies 29% of all irrigation and drinking water in Iran. Tell us about that, because I take it if you were to go after Natanz and Isfahan, these are buried underground, so you'd need these kind of bunker buster bombs, which would blow up deep in the ground and I assume would reach the aquifer.
Yes, a report was done that if the U.S. were to bomb the Isfahan facilities, there would be severe danger of forcing radioactive material down into this key aquifer, which provides nearly a third of Iran's potable water. Iran is an arid country. It doesn't have rainfall in most of the country very often. We consider rainfall agriculture only to be possible with 10 inches a year or more. And much of Iran does not get that. It's only in the far northwest of the country that you see that. So Iran were it to be deprived of this aquifer, large swaths of it would become uninhabitable. It would be a massive motivator for displacement and creation of millions of refugees.
And again, I'm speaking with Awan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan. He's also the author of the blog Informed Comment at awancole.com and the author of The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Engaging the Muslim World. And his latest book is Muhammad, Prophet of Peace Amid the Clash of Empires. And his latest article at Informed Comment is Trump's requested strike on Iran could kill more people than atomic bombing of Nagasaki. So we know that, well, we're told, by, the reporting comes from the New York Times, that this meeting took place last Thursday in the Oval Office. Trump asked for, I don't know, plans or whatever, or permission, I don't know what, how to put that, with his top aides, Secretary of Defense, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and his Vice President. He wants to go after Iran. They apparently talked him out of it. Prior to that, apparently, he'd also tasked the National Security Council to provide him with options. So it doesn't sound like you can really do a wag-the-dog war, can you, before this election that's going to be containable, that will somehow, you know, I mean, he's looking for a Hail Mary, isn't he, because he's lost the election and he's involved in all kinds of mischief in your state of Michigan, by the way, which we just covered in the previous interview. So I guess the bottom line here is there's just no sort of surgical way that you can have a nice little TV war, boost your ratings, and somehow retrieve the fact that you lost an election by millions of votes and by a huge majority, or by the same majority in the Electoral College that you won by in 2016.
No, a strike on Iran wouldn't affect the outcome of the U.S. election, which is over, and I don't think that Trump is very likely to be able to overturn the results of that election. But I think another important motivation for Trump and his team to think about a strike on Iran would be to prevent incoming president-elect Joe Biden from reaching out to Iran and successfully restoring the 2015 joint comprehensive plan of action, or the nuclear deal that was signed with the United States and with the permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany. And that deal requires Iran to reduce the level to which it enriches uranium, to reduce the sophistication and the number of the centrifuges it's allowed to use, and requires regular UN inspections of nuclear sites. All of these steps would prevent Iran ever from weaponizing its civilian nuclear energy program. And no country has ever developed a nuclear device that has been under regular UN inspections. The Trump administration breached this treaty that had been signed with the United States, threw it in the trash can. And one of the features of the treaty was that the U.S. and the United Nations would agree to remove all economic sanctions on Iran, and Iran would gradually be integrated into the world economy. Trump not only didn't do that, but he turned around, breached the treaty, and then slapped a kind of trade and financial embargo on Iran, using the U.S. Treasury Department, twisted the arms of Iran's trading partners not to buy oil from Iran, got Saudi Arabia to produce extra oil, flood the market so that they could go someplace else for the oil and not just to Iran, and destroyed the Iranian petroleum industry, in the sense that Iran was exporting 2.5 million barrels a day in 2017. The last I knew, it was exporting a few tens of thousands of barrels a day. So Trump has attempted to strangle the Iranian economy in this way, despite Iran having been certified to have complied with the requirements of the treaty. Now, since Trump breached the treaty, Iran has been acting out in minor ways. It's enriched uranium slightly above what was allowed as a way of putting pressure on Europe. But let us be clear, Iran does not have a nuclear weapons program. Its program is merely for enriching uranium as fuel for its reactor at Bushehr, which France and South Korea and lots of countries in the United States has 100 nuclear reactors. This is a very common practice. There's no evidence that Iran knows how to enrich to 95%, which is what is necessary for a bomb. And so these minor breaches of the JCPOA are intended as a kind of diplomacy to put pressure on Europe to defy Trump, which it has not done in any practical way, and to remove the trade embargo, which was the very reason for which Iran had given up 80% of its nuclear enrichment capability.
Well, apparently, according to the International Atomic Energy Agency, Iran has a stockpile of about 5,400 pounds of low-enriched uranium, and given the ratio of 6 parts per 1,000 for U-235, then that would be basically enough for 2 bombs. But as you point out, they're a long way from that. And even if they have a plan for a bomb, which AQ Khan allegedly sold them, still they're a long way. And Israel, of course, is a major nuclear power, as is the United States. So I can't see any reason in the world why, unless they were totally suicidal, if they could get a bomb, how they would use it. But apparently, we're hearing from the head of the AJC, he met with Netanyahu, and he's saying, Harris is saying, that Netanyahu's quite happy to say nice things about Joe Biden at this point, but if Biden in any way tries to revive the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, all bets are off. So is that what you're understanding?
Well, certainly Trump is, and the Trump administration is being pressed by Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Bahrain on the one hand, and by Israel on the other, which are some of America's strongest allies in the Middle East, to do everything they can to disrupt the possibility for a Biden rapprochement with Iran. And the Iranians, by the way, say that Biden could simply lift the sanctions and return to complying with the JCPOA, and that Iran would the next day return to observing its obligations. And so the deal can be restored, from the Iranian point of view at least, very easily. And it seems entirely possible that that's what Joe Biden will do, since he was part of the Obama team that made the treaty in the first place. Certainly, Netanyahu will squawk about this. And we saw he came when Obama was negotiating the deal. Netanyahu came and addressed Congress and attacked him and attacked the deal and attempted to dissuade Congress from voting for it. So and he failed. But Netanyahu kind of considers himself a player in American politics, and he is to some extent, because he's backed by a very large number of American evangelicals and then a section of the Israel lobbies. So he would certainly attempt to undermine Biden. If the Democrats don't have the Senate, then he would work the Republicans in the Senate to attempt to forbid Biden from using government funds, for instance, to restore the JCPOA. This is how they stopped Obama from closing Guantanamo. So, yes, Netanyahu will be a thorn in Biden's side were he to decide to return to the JCPOA. But it should be underlined that Trump's policies, which were pressed on him by Netanyahu in Israel and by the Saudis and others in the Gulf, haven't worked the severe or maximum pressure campaign, they call it, the economic and financial embargo on Iran, hasn't had the desired effect. It has permitted Iran, with impunity, to go back to flaunting some of the requirements of the JCPOA. It hasn't stopped Iran from backing the government in Syria or from mobilizing Shiite militias in Iraq or from giving whatever little help it gives to the Houthi rebels in Yemen or from working on its ballistic missiles. All of the ancillary issues that the Trump administration maintained that Obama hadn't attended to in the treaty, because Obama focused on what was most important, which was the nuclear aspect. All of those things haven't actually been resolved in any way. There's been no movement, and Iran hasn't backed off. So the Trump policy, which Netanyahu and others would press on Biden, is a failure.
Well, that's not going to stop them, though. And as you mentioned, you're concerned about 2024. If Trump decides to run again, they'll keep this whole thing alive. But if they do anything stupid, the U.S. troops in Iraq are particularly vulnerable, particularly if Trump pulls more of them out, as he's promising to do. They just had some rockets fired at the Green Zone the other night, just as a signal of what retaliation the Iranians are capable of. So I hope that wiser heads prevail, and I thank you for joining us here today, Juan Cole.
Thanks so much for having me in, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan. He's also the author of the blog Informed Comment at juancole.com and the author of The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Engaging the Muslim World. And his latest book is Muhammad, Prophet of Peace Amid the Clash of Empires. And his latest article at Informed Comment is Trump's Requested Strike on Iran Could Kill More People Than Atomic Bombing of Nagasaki. We're going to take a brief station break and back speaking with the author of an op-ed at the Los Angeles Times, How Biden Can Stop Truth Decay and Restore the Public's Faith in Politics.
Oh yeah, yeah, oh yeah, yeah, war is not the answer. Politician and them bobo nighting, yeah. War is not the answer. Thinking over the solution, Rasta says, yeah. War is not the answer. Tell the politician and them start drop them bomb, yeah. War is not the answer. Thinking over the solution, Rasta says, yeah. War is not the answer.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Jennifer Kavanaugh, who's a director of the Strategy, Doctrine, and Resource Program at the Rand Arroyo Center and a senior political science at the Rand Corporation. She also leads Rand's Countering Truth Decay Initiative, a portfolio of projects exploring the diminishing reliance on facts and analysis in the United States political and civil discourse. And she has an op-ed at the Los Angeles Times, How Biden Can Stop Truth Decay and Restore the Public's Faith in Facts. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jennifer Kavanaugh.
Thanks for having me.
So you are fighting the good fight, trying to create a reality-based community in post-truth America?
Well, we certainly are interested in making sure that the political and civil discourse and policy decisions are made based on fact.
So are we in post-truth America?
No, we don't think so. That's why we use the term truth decay, because we don't see people rejecting and moving away from facts in all areas of life. If you think about business, sports, even the military, these are places where there's an increasing focus on big data and data analytics and trying to make decisions that are data driven. It's really in this, in politics and in political and civil discourse, that is the discussions that we have about key policy issues in the public space. It's in those areas where people seem increasingly comfortable to rely on opinion and anecdote instead of facts. So we don't think that it's a post-fact era, because it's not happening everywhere, but it does seem that this reliance on facts is diminishing in certain really important domains.
Well, certainly in sports, if you had alternative facts in sports and you decided who won the baseball game by what and the football game by what, that would be totally surreal. But what I find interesting about what you're trying to do here is, and we know in our political discussions, there've been a lot of talk about fixing our crumbling infrastructure, roads and bridges, etc. And there was supposed to be an infrastructure package forthcoming from the Trump administration. And one of the things that pundits are saying now is that Joe Biden, in reaching out to the Republicans, since he's always had a pretty good relationship with Mitch McConnell, and they've known each other for decades, that they may be able to put together a infrastructure package, which they could cooperate on in the absence of anything else. So, but nobody's talking about investing in the nation's civic infrastructure. So talk about that, if you will, that need.
Well, I think that we think about civic infrastructure as being the network between people, an understanding of what is the role of government, what is the role of media, a trust not only in government and media institutions, as well as other civic institutions, but a trust in each other. And right now we live in a society where there's so many lines of polarization, politics, social, demographic, economic. And so this means that everyone's really living having a very different experience. And those divides keep us from having this kind of shared responsibility to a common goal or to a common set of goals. And so I think that when we think about rebuilding a civic infrastructure, we think about trying to rebuild that framework that is so important to the functioning of democracy. If you think about the way in which policy decisions are made, if policymakers can't agree on a common set of facts, then rather than having a policy debate about policy options and priorities, they're spending all of their time arguing about what the facts are. And that makes it difficult to make progress on really important topics like immigration and healthcare and climate change, things that require sustained investment and bipartisan commitment. That's what we're missing. And so when we talk about civic infrastructure, that's what we're aiming at rebuilding, is some of the frameworks, the interpersonal institutional trust, and the broader understanding and sense of belonging, not in a small tribe, but in this common goal, which is a better America.
But how much would education or revamping education play a role? Because we used to teach civics in high school, but not anymore.
Well, I think education plays a big role in a number of different ways. Education is one place where we have, for lack of a better term, sort of a captive audience. We have a way to reach a large number of students at once. Now, it doesn't mean that the education that works in one place or the curricula that work in one place are going to work in every other place, but it does give us a vehicle to reach students. And so I think there's a number of types of literacies that need to be focused on or given additional resourcing and attention. And that includes civic literacy, which would be an understanding of what it means to live in a democracy. What is this, the citizen's responsibility? What's the government's responsibility? What's the role of the media? What do we share? What common values do we share as Americans rather than what makes us different? Media literacy, the ability to navigate online spaces as well as offline, to look for information, to create and share information. And then there's other things like science literacy. So many policy issues are tied up in science. And if we don't have a sense of how science knowledge evolves, it can be really difficult for people to navigate and form informed opinions on those issues. And then things like statistics. How can you read polls and other types of news articles if you can't understand the basic statistics behind them? So as data becomes increasingly prevalent, people need better statistics skills to navigate that space. So there's a whole web of interrelated literacies that I think schools could do a better job of providing students with to help and make them be better prepared when they come out of school to both participate effectively in a democracy, but also have the knowledge and experiences that allow them to feel connected to the broader government framework, not necessarily to the government, but a sense of belonging to the nation rather than to a smaller tribe, as I said before.
And again, I'm speaking with Jennifer Kavanaugh, who's Director of the Strategy, Doctrine, and Resources Program in the RAND Arroyo Center and a senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation. She also leads RAND's Countering Truth Decay Initiative, a portfolio of projects exploring the diminishing reliance on facts and analysis in U.S. political and civil discourse. And she has an op-ed at the Los Angeles Times, How Biden Can Stop Truth Decay and Restore the Public's Faith in Facts. Now, you mentioned the media. I think since the explosion of social media, I think one of the statistics we've heard is that about two-thirds or three-quarters of Americans get their news and information via Facebook. And what's happened is that there's been an atomization where left-wingers get their information from MSNBC, right-wingers from Fox, Christians from Christian Broadcasting, etc. So there's no consensus about what is true and what is real, and the phenomenon is called reality shopping. So obviously there's no way to legislate a way around that, but what could you do in terms of some sort of stern disciplinarian that just enough already, you know, we can't function as a nation unless we believe on, you know, certain basic facts.
Well, in terms of the media fragmentation, I do agree that that's a challenge. I mean, there's definitely benefits to having a diversity of news sources, and social media provides a number of benefits in the ability to elevate minority voices and make sure that we have diversity in terms of who gets to be a voice and who sets the agenda. And I think that those are positive things. But it comes along with a number of more negative things having to do with the quality of information. And as you said, people who hone in on one set of sources and don't get that diversity of information, which can be really important to gaining a fuller perspective of key issues and then having a common set of knowledge that allows us to have robust civic discussions, both individuals and policymakers. So I agree that's a challenge. In terms of addressing that challenge, I think there's a number of factors that have to be considered. One is the reason why media has fragmented like this is really about profit, and it's about the changing economics of the industry as things have shifted online. And so I think there's one set of questions about what is a sustainable model for journalism and news going forward. Right now, we have a lot of publications that are partisan or that provide kind of one set of niche views. And they do that to attract their audience and to get the advertising dollars they need to stay in business. So what can we do to change the economics of the media industry that provide a different set of incentives and promote more of the objective fact-based information that would allow us to build that common set of facts? Now, that doesn't mean that everybody has to interpret things the same way. It's good to have diversity, but we also need a more robust presence for this objective information. So I think that that's one set of solutions. And I think the other set of solutions goes back to education. One thing that people should be learning in media or civic literacy is the need to look at multiple sources. You can't rely on only one source for your information because everything has bias and filter and lenses. So any source you look at is going to tell only part of the story. And so in order to be fully informed on an issue, you do have to consult multiple sources. And that means that you do have to invest time. So alongside education, there might be changes that could be made to make that process of seeking out multiple perspectives easier. And certainly there are some apps and other types of platforms that do provide a more diverse media diet, but they have much less uptake than some of the more extreme things on the polls.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Jennifer, I can't imagine as an educator you can't sort of instill intellectual curiosity in a young person. I assume it has to come from them, and I don't know how you can instill or encourage critical thinking, but we certainly need it. As a journalist, in many ways, it seems to me that the reason people sort of are in their own bubbles and in their own silos is that there's a certain comfort factor. And as a journalist, you are sort of supposed to be, in many ways, cynical and skeptical and not believe the first thing you hear. And certainly not to feel like you have all the answers. Your job is to keep asking questions. So How do you create a culture of skepticism, if indeed you feel that's necessary?
Well, I do think that you need skepticism, but you don't want cynicism. And that's a fine line. And so teaching students how to be skeptical and to ask questions and to not accept everything that they see at first glance is important, but also teaching them that, you know, questioning everything and thinking that there's a conspiracy theory behind every piece of information you read can also be detrimental. And so walking that balance between the two, I think, is really important. I think one way that this can be accomplished is by, rather than splitting out skills like civics and media literacy and even science and math into, focusing on the civic aspect of all of those subjects as a separate course, or focusing on media literacy as a separate course, is to really integrate that into the other classes that students are already taking. So integrating it into language arts classes, integrating it into social studies classes, so that students are learning about how to process and question and produce and share information in the context in which they're actually going to be using it in their real lives. That process will teach them much more that's applicable and that will become ingrained in their worldview and their understanding of information than trying to teach them a set of skills as a module that's off on the side that they then have to figure out how to apply in context. The former approach changes the worldview and the way information is seen and processed. And the latter view teaches sort of a set of skills that are like a Band-Aid on a bigger problem. And so the former way, I think, gets at this idea of teaching a healthy skepticism.
Well, Jennifer Kavanagh, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. This was a great discussion.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Jennifer Kavanagh, who's the director of the Strategy, Doctrine, and Resources Program at the Rand Arroyo Center and a senior political science at the Rand Corporation. She also leads Rand's Countering Truth Decay Initiative, a portfolio of projects exploring the diminishing reliance on facts and analysis in U.S. political and civil discourse. And she has an op-ed at the Los Angeles Times, How Biden Can Stop Truth Decay and Restore the Public's Faith in Facts. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. To help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate free, we have added a donate button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Lady dressed in white with a man she loved, standing along the side of the pickup truck. Bye.